Thorn in Your Side is a podcast recorded on the various lands of First Nations peoples, land that always was and always will be Aboriginal land. While there's air that is breathed and water that nourishes and provides, ownership of this land remains unresolved. Respects are paid to elders past and present in the ongoing quest for self-determination and reclamation of land.
Thorn in your side, you know that's all you'll ever be.
Hello everyone, this is M. Welcome to Thorn in Your Side, and I am doing a Lone Wolf episode. So I wanted to go over a few things in this episode. So it's more or less what's been on my mind over the last week or so, or even fortnight perhaps. It's not only just the usual personal schlock that I've been going through in the last Lone Wolf episodes of recent note, but a few things are just going on in the world that I wouldn't mind just putting my two cents towards. But otherwise,
so what do you guys want to talk about?
So just in regards to me checking in, I think this is definitely feeling like a case of a year of recovery for me. I'm starting to feel a bit more brighter and chipper. I'm back at the gym, so it feels like I'm starting to get the blood rushing around the organs a bit more, helping me get a bit more alert. But it's also been quite handy to actually get my head around all the neurodiverse stuff. I think that if that's anything that's been attached to having a positive experience from last year, from what otherwise has been quite a painful experience, it was, I think, a time of really, really quite intrusively figuring out what the fuck was going on. And I feel like I'm kind of getting the returns of that now, being able to just function, doing things day to day without having that nagging thought at the back of my head going, something's not quite right here, things just don't add up, what's happening. I think half the battle was trying to put my finger on what things were about. I suppose if there is an amount of regret that I'm trying to work through, it is the fact that it has taken me to my mid-40s to kind of get there. And I do feel like I'm kind of behind schedule about 10 to 15 years, but I'm increasingly trying to assure myself that I think it's been probably a good thing to actually get there to be able to finally get my head around what's going on, because there was never any guarantee that that was going to happen. So I think it was something of a triumph in itself to be able to get that assurance and clarity and actualization, to use the psychological, pop psychological lingo. So that's that. And I think now that I've been able to kind of address a lot of the personal shit, it's helped me to kind of look a bit more outwards. Not that I haven't always been doing that, but perhaps having a bit more space and energy to outwardly engage and looking at what the world's doing. Maybe the first thing I kind of want to have a look at is this idea of the rise of nationalism. I am noticing that there have been a few recent election victories in Europe and South America, where there have been some emergent far-right tickets, and to me that's kind of reflective of the gradual withering away, I suppose, of liberal structures that emerged post-World War II. So if I might offer a few examples, like thinking of the things that are somewhat familiar to people, like the United Nations and NATO and the European Union, all of these structures set up for greater coordination and coherence between national economic systems and regional ones, which allows for greater legal and economic coherence. And that's also been backed up with this idea of Keynesian thoughts of meeting aggregate demand. So actually making a conscious effort of identifying what the needs are and how many people need this and how many people over there need that, and really trying to have an interventionist amount of governments and world organizations that can look at putting in place systemically what can actually meet that demand. And I think your most immediate example I can think that comes to mind was that real post-World War II housing boom, where major cities really started developing urban sprawls as people became more accustomed to purchasing houses and just having a bit more self-determination, at least economically anyway, that idea of having a full-time job and having a sustainable income and a job for life. Although there's still an amount of problems associated with that, in that there's that adherence to the nuclear family, where you have the white male breadwinner and the housewife who provides the unpaid labor at home and the kids. That idea of white bread paradise, which in itself produces an amount of inequalities that go across class structures that are framed along economic disparities, racial disparities, geographic distances, you know, like the north side of Sydney versus the south side of Sydney, and then the greater west, southwestern fringes, to use another Australian example. All of that just kept washing up against each other as the latter half of the 20th century permeated. So anyway, all of that was all bound together in some sort of liberal democratic project, which had various degrees of success, but it was about competing against the socialist threat, which was represented through the Cold War.
Must crush capitalism.
So all of that winds down in the 80s with the development of neoliberalism. And that was a 40-year project which kind of wound down, I'd say, in the late noughties. And we saw that particularly through the global financial crisis, where consumption, or the ability for a class base to maintain its standard for itself, looking out for itself, maintaining one's lifestyle, living relaxed and comfortably, or at least trying to maintain the pretension to do so, having the agency to consume, that was really starting to fall on its ass by the late noughties. And that was particularly represented by the ability to nail down a mortgage. And confidence towards that really did get smashed, particularly within American and European markets, European housing markets, where an inability to be able to recoup debts made on mortgages increasingly became apparent between mortgage holders. So with all the defaults, there started to be a collective market panic, and then that was expressed through defaults and bankruptcies. And then suddenly all these different foreclosure companies coming out of the woodwork to buy up all of these houses for a song, with the expectation of economic recovery. They can sell those houses back out into the general house buying marketplace and making a profit. There was a collapse of neoliberalism in that sense, but in its place came parasitic forms of capitalism. Naomi Klein and Anthony Lowenstein talk about disaster capitalism, and seeing these security firms that pop up in war-torn countries where they produce contracted police armies. And we particularly saw that during Iraq, was Halliburton stepped in for a presumed recovery of public capital works within Iraq, but all to the tune of Halliburton making a profit as a consequence. So I think any overarching economic programs or doctrines pretty much collapsed after the Cold War. There was a meandering, I'd say, for about 10 to 15 years to continue with capitalism as a presumed prevailing economic model that was at least not as bad as the rest. But I think we saw by the noughties that it pretty much went tits up. So I guess in a very long-winded way, I'm trying to get to my point of saying, what has replaced it, or what is replacing it? And there's a few things going on, but the main example I wanted to head towards was the idea of the rise of the nationalisms. And I think a big point of contention here is whether or not these rise of nationalist movements are a proto-form of fascism, so a recreation in many ways of some of the activities that happened in the middle of World War I and World War II, or this is a new political phenomenon that's happening altogether.
What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white name. Proud
Boys, stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
Crush capitalism.
There was a recent article within The Guardian, which I can provide a link at the bottom of the episode, where they talk about the idea of competing fears. So it's not about boiling things down to an emergent far-right movement, but rather something that intends to move away from ideology, from the left and the right wing, to isolated fears where everyone has their own thoughts and concerns and positions over what the problem is, rather than coalescing upon a particular ideology to create an explanation of what's going on and what to rally around. So examples of that being the fear upon climate change, the fear upon economic disorder, the fear of being able to retain one's ability to accumulate property, and of course your emerging far-right movements, which are increasingly getting footprints within national parliaments in Europe, in South America, and within other pockets of the world. And I think for me that is where things are at, to see what manifests. And I think an upcoming litmus test is the US elections. It's seeming like Trump is becoming increasingly like the front runner to get a second term in the US office. A unique trajectory as a US president by having two separate terms rather than running two continuous terms. And to attain this second round of administration against the backdrop of fraud and criminal charges, with the backing of various far-right groups within the US, and also, and I suppose most pertinent to this discussion, having the support of the majority of the Republican Party, of which it's becoming increasingly obvious that this is about just doing whatever is based upon maintaining one's own individual interests. You know, the quid pro quo is if you have a dude like Trump in there, there can be some arrangements to be made where Republican members can find ways of asserting their own power bases and votes and authority within the US political structure. So there is an amount of fear over the potential behind that and what things might degenerate into, because, I mean, fascism sucks. But it's never basically the right-wing utopian end that it's cracked up to be. It will degenerate into civil war. And I'd just like to see where things kind of amount to, because at this point I feel like it's about looking into the crystal ball and predicting where things might lie into the future. And I try my best not to predict things, but in the US, it's becoming increasingly and fearfully apparent that's looking like a second term for history's greatest huckster. That's my rants on the rise of nationalism. The next thing I wanted to discuss was what's happening in the Gaza Strip. Now, I've often been pretty critical about the capacity of capital H, capital L, the left, to organize and coalesce. But I think there has been a strength in recent months in the ability to provide a voice, or to facilitate, or to support, or to provide solidarity to the Palestinian movement. And whilst one could immediately think that that's relating to the idea of a Palestinian state, which of course has its meritorious ideas, particularly with the idea of having a final two-state solution within the Gaza Strip with Israel, I feel that's only part of it, because the ultimate thing at the moment is the ultimate survival of a peoples. And I think that is the immediate issue. There is not the freedom and the agency to work out what national rights people have at the moment. This appears to be an effective extermination that's currently happening in the Gaza Strip at the moment. And I think this is all part of an agenda of a Zionist far-right push.
Imagine there's no heaven.
I think what particularly represents the composition of this has been Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been in Israel for, or assumed the post of the highest point of authority within Israel for decades now. And I think where there is that career maintaining that post, it's degenerated into doing whatever it takes for such an individual to maintain his ability to hold down that office. And recently, against the backdrop of charges of fraud, I believe, there's been an attempt to find a buffer away from that with trying to secure votes with far-right parties within Israel. Once a coalition has been struck, I think the results of that have been increasingly austere and violent measures towards settlements and land on the West Bank. And that's increasingly led to further marginalizations and violence towards Palestinian settlements, areas which were effectively and universally considered to be Palestinian domain, have been encroached upon, and a lot of Palestinian residents have been displaced consequently. And also that pervasive state of affairs that happens where Palestinian people are feeling constantly under surveillance, where there is active forms of surveillance based upon racism, where if you do look a particular way or dress in a particular way, you're guaranteed of being inspected, dressed down, and having to claim who and what your reasons are for being in a particular place at a particular time. All of that does culminate in feelings of oppression and also class differences, in this instance based upon clear lines of ethnicity and religion. And that has particularly come to the fore in the last decade, where we're seeing very much far-right populist government asserting an agenda towards a one-state arrangement, which leads to the marginalization of an ethnicity and with claims for its own nationhood, but continuously being perceived as a threat rather than a neighbor.
People that think that all that matters is power. And as long as you're chasing power, you can do whatever you want. You could be as ruthless as you want, as cutthroat as you want. You could rule with an iron fist. You can oppress whoever, whenever, as long as it's in the name of power. So that's fine. If that's the name of your game, fine. But understand that if that's your game, my name is not Sami Zayn. My name is Rebellion. My name is Resistance!
I think for me this is about, if there's any activist response to this, is at least trying to assert the right for existence and survival of Palestinian peoples. And I think that has come across in many ways through the variety of actions that have happened, dialogues that have been happening, particularly at an increasingly mainstream and popular level, and also what has been happening towards unpacking exactly what's happening, like the reasons why there is that Israel state advocacy. And an interesting quote was made by a friend of mine on this, and says the following in a recent article where they mention, "Jewish community memory of the Holocaust is ever present for us. It is a scar in our community." And I might also preface that my friend is also of Jewish ethnicity. And they finish up by saying, "But that memory is being weaponized by Israel." I think it's a pretty useful quote in the fact that it is separating this idea of statehood and Judaism, where I think there's commonly this confusion between both. and it creates this, I guess, weaponizing arrangement where if anyone is ever critical of what is happening with regards to Israeli nationalism, they're automatically disregarded as being anti-Semitic. But I don't feel that this is actually an argument against Judaism and Jewish ethnicity. Rather, this is a question of state assertion. And whenever you see that kind of activity happening, you try and figure out exactly who benefits from such activity and who suffers from that activity. And I think that's definitely, that is explaining a reason with regard to providing advocacy for Palestinian peoples and recognizing struggles within Palestinian peoples and the movements that are happening. And I think on top of that, it's also, I think, a pretty healthy activity to unpack that difference between Zionism or idealisms towards Israeli statehood versus the idea of bundling all of that together with Judaism. So I think it's very useful exercises to at least trying to make sense of what's happening. That's what's helping me sort of understand what's happening over there and exactly what stance or what one opinion can be formed against the events that are happening on the Gaza Strip. I just think an immediate thing at the moment is to actually look at what exactly or who exactly is suffering as a result of those events, to the point of the potential risk of complete genocidal eradication of a peoples. And I'm trying not to say that in a very dramatic way. At the very least, that further consolidates an inequality between ethnic groups and a competition between interests. I think it's good to identify it in that manner as opposed to some overarching concept of peace. And I think, what was it, about a month or so ago, I attended this political talk at a pub in the Inner West. Politics in the Pub, I believe it's called. I go there now and again, perhaps not so much in recent years because of COVID, where my movements become fewer and far in between. But I decided to turn up that particular night because there seemed to be a real dedication to talking about issues pertaining to the Gaza Strip. And there were a few talkers. The usual suspects were part of the panel, but also a couple of Palestinian speakers. And what I particularly got out of that was the idea of exactly what types of oppressive circumstances are happening within the Gaza Strip and what activities are arising in response to basically fight for one's right to survive. That seemed to be the message I was receiving. But I guess what was frustrating to also hear within that panel was the same tired, drawn-out solutions of peace and talking about using clumsy metaphors such as let's produce an orchestra where we're hearing the different tunes and the different sections of the orchestral entity and we'll come up with this big operatic piece where everyone basically contributes to creating this final musical score that will lead to peace. A really shitty metaphor. And also one that again came from an old white male where compared the situation to that of a footy match where you have to kind of work out which teams are on the pitch and then trying to work out exactly how to better play the game and come up with a result that's going to benefit one team. And it's about playing good footy. So, I mean, these days my trips into the city from out Campbelltown way are pretty valuable subtractions of my time. So I was pretty frustrated to actually go out that way that night into the Inner West and hear all of that. And it's like, well, fuck, you know, while eating my overly inflated pub meal. Yeah, I mean, it was worth listening to the Palestinian voices that night. But and maybe the other thing, maybe as a side issue that night that was really pissing me off as well, it's like, Just seeing all the inner West usual suspects there. These people with that are sitting on basically a housing nest egg and may or may not be in retirement and basically having an existential crisis about and feelings of guilt about what to do and where does one become active and how does one offer their own ways of moving forward, whether it be talking about orchestras or footy matches. And the irony I'm seeing, it's, and you're even seeing it as immediate as in the western suburbs, people just basically fighting tooth and nail to be able to gain some property, whether it be as an apartment or as a house or as a share house or being able to find some sort of sustainable rental arrangement. People are way immersed in within all of that, let alone having the space and time to take a step back and looking at what greater issues might be happening internationally, one of those being what's happening in the Gaza Strip. So it's not apathy, it's just that people are confronting a bunch of immediate problems. So I think that's the view I want to have on that at the moment, and maybe moving forward, I think it bleeds, there's themes in this that bleed into my previous issue that I raised in this episode with regards to rises of nationalism and populism. We're definitely seeing that imprint within affairs that are affecting the Middle East. The desperate maintenance of what Netanyahu is doing to be able to for him to maintain his authority, democratic authority, by coalescing with increasingly far-right organizations as part of the Israeli parliamentary structure. So I think for me, it's about just really monitoring and seeing what I can do to basically support and work with Palestinian activist efforts to at least try to maintain the idea of right to existence.
Yo.
And so my final issue that I'd like to cross over is, and this is taking a big knee jerk, I suppose, is Vince McMahon. And more specifically, a couple of issues that have happened regarding him in the last week or so. So I've gone from wacko far-right global events to wacko far-right capitalist events.
Come on out, you rapist!
Wow.
So for people that aren't aware who Vince McMahon is, he's the owner of World Wrestling Entertainment. Or actually, I lie now. He used to be the owner. He's currently resigned, but his last post before resigning was he was actually the executive chairman of a consortium of which the WWE was one part, because I think a year or so ago there was a big merger that happened between WWE, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, and I think a couple of other smaller organizations that were also associated with Full Body Contact Sports Entertainment. So anyway, it was this big corporate marriage, and Vince was able to maintain some involvement in that in some way, in this instance being a board chairman. So what's come to the surface is that a lady has tendered a legal affidavit within the US making allegations that during her tenure as an employee within the WWE, this individual was subject to, I guess, obscene and high-level degrees of sexual assault and rape on the part of Vince McMahon and with a few other associates at the time, of which another executive staff member within the WWE has been named. And also ancillary to that is a few other unnamed individuals that may be professional wrestlers or employees. But at this point in time, there seem to be two particular individuals of which allegations have been particularly addressed toward. One being Vince McMahon and the other one being the employee that goes by the stage name of Johnny Ace, but otherwise known as John Laurinaitis, who assumed his real name in maybe the last decade of WWE kayfabe or storyline, because these days, I think there's a general acknowledgement or official acknowledgement that wrestling is fake. Well, not really fake, but perhaps, well, I mean, it's probably the same way as saying like theater or movies are fake. It is about trying to come up with the best version of immersive fiction as possible. And if you can kind of bleed it together with reality as much as possible, then that's really creating an art form. So where I'm coming from is that in the last decade or so, John Laurinaitis used his real name rather than Johnny Ace, making the gap between fiction or kayfabe and reality ever more narrower. And what even makes it even more and more narrow is the fact that Vince McMahon is appears to be a lot more monstrous in real life than the heel persona that he particularly portrayed in the late 90s and early 90s with the Mr. McMahon role. So basically the allegations I won't really go into the brass tacks of because they are quite, I would say, triggering for anyone that has ever encountered intense experiences of entrapment or sexual assault, because the activities that have been mentioned in this legal affidavit are quite extreme. And if what has been raised here is truthful, then I would definitely hazard to say that that Vince McMahon is quite a monstrous individual, hopped up on cocaine, very bored and very desperate. So for me, that just kind of immediately says, well, is this guy like a true reflection of modern day capitalists? Like I say, I at the risk of glossing over some of the issues that have been raised here, I think what I particularly want to focus upon at the moment is exactly how does a guy get to have the space, the agency, and the power to be able to act in such an abusive way? And I mean, there's that idea of someone being innocent until proven guilty, but I think the track record of Vince over the last few decades would suggest that there is validity to what has been alleged in terms of some of the egregious actions that Vince has pertained to during this time with this individual. So I think it was between 2019 and 2021. And I've just been kind of looking at YouTubes and reading articles and reading comments. And one particular thing that tends to keep popping up is something that comes from the incel community, where there's suddenly this idea of, oh, well, if she didn't like what she was getting into and what she was continually exposing herself to, surely she could have chosen to walk away from it at any time. Now, firstly, like, I'm not necessarily sure this is something that was basically enjoyable. From what I can understand, this individual was employed by Vince McMahon under the pretenses of being an employee with World Wrestling Entertainment, an administrative role. But as the submission would attest, it was pretty much a front to basically being a sex trafficked individual. And there's a whole bunch of examples that the individual alleges went down to affirm that. And other employees of the WWE were also involved, which would suggest that there was a ring, another kind of ring, not a wrestling ring, so please, no pun intended, ring of participants towards taking part in this sex trafficking practice. So what is particularly confronting to me is how, if all of these allocations are true, what is immediately confronting to me is exactly how Vince McMahon was able to be in a position and to be able to have the agency to carry out all of these activities with impunity. Early on in the affidavit, was there seemed to be very conscious activities towards grooming and entrapment. One particular statement that seemed to really stick out for me was a comment from Mr. McMahon that so it served as a bit of a passive-aggressive warning to the individual, where he states to them that just be careful of what you're doing. I mean, I'm not using adverbatim here, just basically paraphrasing. Be careful what you do, and what you say, because I have an attorney, and my attorney is very good at making issues disappear. So straight up, there was a very veiled threat that if you do or act untoward, not only will you lose your job, but also the potential of your livelihood as well. And also, I think the circumstances of the individual is worth meriting an examination as well, where I believe that that this individual's parents had recently passed away, of which this person was in a caregiving role. Their housing circumstances were basically under threat as a consequence, and they weren't necessarily sure of their future employment prospects. So they kind of came into this this opportunity with the WWE from a position of economic desperation. And here's good old Vince basically presenting himself as a saintly benefactor. But right from the start, it was definitely a case of exploiting a situation, as it would seem. So, I mean, I suppose part of my answer towards this idea about how such a monster can be so monstrous is that through having such agency is having all of these places of privilege and being able to pull the strings associating with that privilege. Having that good attorney that can make problems go away. And I guess that's perhaps the legal options that Vince has available. I was hazard to say that perhaps he also has other more illegal means that are available to him also, which, I mean, to maybe talk about would be highly speculative, but I would hazard to say that they are likely there at his disposal. And I also think that this isn't an instance that's in isolation. I feel like there's been a number of people that have been in this situation with Vince previously also, and I would not be surprised if a few more cases of this ilk arise in the weeks to come, and potentially leading towards some sort of class action or series of lawsuits against Vince McMahon. At the moment, everything seems to be processed right now as a civil matter, although I would hope that that it sort of moves into, or it does move into, the criminal into the months ahead, depending upon who and what comes out of the woodwork. But it seems like there is some sort of accountability that's suddenly emerging here, and kind of tells me that this is what the rich people get up to these days, and how they kind of have this lifestyle that seems to assert this idea of exceptionalism and very much laced up with this idea of ego. Because if you're against that type of lifestyle, then obviously you must be envious or jealous, and therefore it's a politics of envy. I just think that it's so totally dysfunctional and fucked up that someone rich enough to be able to basically act in such a monstrous way in a ways to display overtly forms of power by saying, look, I'm rich enough, so therefore I have the right to be able to do these fucked up things and play out power fantasies in all the various forms. That seems to be the want and reason of being a rich capitalist. So again, it's about basically watching an emerging news event unfold and see what might happen. And I think also that that it also potentially dovetails into what I might be talking about in my next episode, which will be with good old mate John McGuire, as we talk about professional wrestling, as I have guiltily found myself once again stumbling upon after something I thought I was going to move away after late childhood and into early adulthood. But unfortunately, or perhaps awesomely, who knows, I've come back into the fold. So part of that has been watching a movie with John called The Iron Claw, and we'll talk about that movie, and on top of that, also talk about professional wrestling and how there seems to be some renaissance that is happening within sports entertainment, and in many ways how this shit that's happened now with Vince McMahon has basically added to the theater of it all. So I'll leave those discussions to that episode. But otherwise, to wrap things up, I'm hoping that this episode's been an attempt to try something a bit more new, to talk a bit more about the events of the day, as well as using it as a check-in time for me, and hopefully working towards something that could be a useful project, not only for me, but for anyone that's listening. So anyone that is listening, I'm highly appreciative, hoping to reach out in some shape or form and at least try to find ways of enhancing this podcasting effort. But for now, thanks everyone. I'll catch you later and stay safe.